Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
They also say he'd be the first potential Mac PGOT holder, which because he's got this MacArthur Foundation
Genius Award.
So he'd be the
Mac
first one with that. And it would have taken him just a total of 9 years to amass all of these things, which would be the shortest amount of time.
Well, he's got the Nobel still.
Yeah, he's still got the Nobel that he's working on. So this is
wait.
And he hasn't taken a stress test.
Does he have the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame? I got that.
Not currently.
Okay.
Not
so currently.
That's going to be
so
difficult.
Come talk to me.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
All righty then. Plausibly live from an as yet undisclosed location on the third floor in Chevy Chase, Maryland. We're on the air with Chris Saliza and Barry Zwerluga. Michael Kornheiser, Nigel's here to run the board and do the news. Andy Poley is with us. Bobby Snyder is with us. I might get him to the microphone. I might not. We're full today. Full. We have Ann Hornaday coming up in a little bit. And obviously, we're going to talk about Mary Tyler Moore, and we're going to talk about Brent Musburger, who this is a bad series of days if you're my age and you're working in the sports business.
Get used to it.
Because sports reporters, as we talked about the other day, it's folded on ESPN, and Brent Musburger is off the air as a play-by-play guy. And we're going to get to all of these things. But I'm going to start with – so I wake up, and as everybody knows, because I say this all the time, I watch the 6 a.m. Sports Center, at least the first 30 minutes of it, so I can get some background of what happened late last night and what maybe people around the country might consider the agenda of stories for the day. And I know something is going on when I tune to Sports Center, which is 8:50 on my dial – and SportsCenter is not on. The Australian Open is on. And I go to find, you know, I just look, and it doesn't even register. I just figured, okay, well, it's still on from last night. And then I go to 8:52, and I get SportsCenter. And then I go back just on a change, and I see that Federer has been up. Roger Federer, who's 35 years old and one of the greatest players of all time. And by the way, heading into last year, you would have said, has no chance to win another major again in his life. Is zero chance. Roger Federer is playing Stan Wawrinka, the Stanimal. They're both from Switzerland, and Wawrinka's beaten his brains out the last few times that they've played. The winner gets to the final of the Australian Open, and Federer was up two sets, and now it's 2-2, and now they're heading into the fifth set, and Federer has just walked off the court for some medical emergency, which means he's either throwing up or has to run to the bathroom. Or if it was me, I would just take a shot of amphetamine in my eyeball so that I could get through the fifth set. So now I'm going back and forth between SportsCenter and the Australian Open. And I also find out that in the Australian Open, Serena Williams, who I assume is going to win, has won, and she's 35. And Venus Williams has beaten Coco Vandeweghe, and she's 36. And you're going to say, well, that's not that old. No, in tennis, that's ancient.
They've been playing since they're 16.
30 is the dividing line. Yeah. It's a surefire dividing line. You begin to slide at 30. The notion that you can reach a major final at 35 or 36 is not simply improbable. It's much closer to impossible. Venus Williams, the last time she was in a final was 2009. The last time she was in an Australian Open final, and she was the best player in the world for about 5 years, was 2003. This is 14 years later. This is not possible. One of the Williams sisters is going to win. Serena is the better player. Part of Serena might say, you know what? My sister has zero chance of ever winning another thing. I'm going to tank it. I'm going to win the first, or I'm going to win the second, but I'm not going to win the third. I don't know. On the other side, Federer gets in. Federer is up 5-2, loses on Wawrinka's serve, couldn't care less, and at 5-3, serves it out at love and misses three first serves.
Wow.
So he's in. And now if Rafael Nadal, who plays in the middle of the night here, but
3:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, just after you wake
if
up.
Rafael Nadal is the youngest of the four people. He's 30 years old. All right.
And, his body is 72 years old, though.
But his body, he plays harder. In the way that Federer glides, Nadal does not glide. Nadal goes through the wall.
Physical game.
Yeah, I mean, he's a football player.
He's a grinder, man.
He's a football player out there. So if all four of them get there, this is an impossible thing to happen. Nobody had this. Nobody bet on this. If I think it would be the oldest group of people to ever get to a final.
Would have to be.
If you said to Federer and Nadal, who, by the way, because of physical problems and not playing very well, were seeded 17th and 15th.
Yep,
they were supposed to be out a week ago. If you said to them, not only are you going to get to the final, but the guy opposite you is that guy, because you were the two best players in the world 10 and 12 years ago, and two of the best players of all time. The only thing that stopped Roger Federer from being the greatest player of all time by anyone's reckoning other than Rod Laver is that Nadal killed him. And so if you don't even dominate your own era, how can you be the greatest player of all time? Beat him like a drum on clay all the time and beat him other places. I mean, I think that Nadal has an all-time winning record against Federer.
I think it's got to be because the clay thing makes it.
Serena Williams has lost more times to her sister than anybody else. Venus is 5-9 against Serena. Five times. Nobody else has ever beaten Serena five times in majors.
I mean,
because she never loses.
That's amazing.
It is. This is the longest shot in the world, this particular group of four, right?
It's got to be, yeah. I mean, the shame of it is that it's happening in the middle of the night and not.
It's Australia. It's not our fault.
We want the U.S. Open.
I'm not blaming you. I was not assigning blame.
They'll never reach this again.
No,
this is it.
Right.
Do you remember Jimmy Connors' run in the 1991?
Didn't win it.
Didn't win it, but he was 39 at the time.
And he was playing at night. He was always playing at night.
Prime time.
Not only for television purposes, but because the sun during the day might have sapped his strength. He was a vampire. He was great.
Was it
the semis?
Aaron Krickstein, didn't he have some?
Five-setter.
Yeah, that's right.
Five-setter, and he beat him. But you won't see this again.
Right.
You're just not going to see it again. And you're not even going to see it now because it's 3 in the morning.
Exactly.
You're not going to see it.
This is Federer's 28th final. It's unbelievable.
I mean, McEnroe was ecstatic. McEnroe was going on.
It's good for tennis. I mean, there's not that many things that are good for tennis anymore.
Hold it. It's good for tennis, but nobody can see it.
But we talked about it. Would we be talking about it if it was Stan Wawrinka versus Djokovic?
Grigor Dimitrov.
Nadal may not get in.
Right.
He may not get in.
We actually would talk about Dimitrov because my wife, Liz, her cousin, is part of his management team.
Oh, Chris works with him. Yeah. So
is he from Georgia?
What's your second
for Dimitrov then?
I'm not going to say where my rooting interest lies. I grew up with Nadal.
Yeah. So,
but is he Georgian, Dimitrov? I'm looking at his flag.
Yeah, he and Jimmy Carter.
Well, that's Bulgaria.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that. I was testing.
And he's actually the 15th seed. Nadal is the 9th seed. Slight correction.
Okay. Do you want which do we have more on? Brent Musburger. Let's go around the room. Do we have more on Brent Musburger or more on Mary Tyler Moore, Barry?
Musburger.
Okay.
I mean, I got nothing on Mary Tyler Moore.
Okay, Michael.
I bow out of this one.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with either.
Okay,
one of these
so then
people.
we'll do Mary Tyler. I'll do
Mary Tyler Moore was
now.
A reporter.
Okay,
and I'm out.
Mary Tyler Moore, she died at 80. She was in two of the greatest sitcoms ever made, The Dick Van Dyke Show, created by Carl Reiner, still alive.
Wow,
92 years old. Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, Norman Lear, still alive.
This is where you try to make yourself feel better about all the bad
things
that
are happening. No. But Carl Reiner was interviewed yesterday about Mary Tyler Moore and why he cast her as the wife of Dick Van Dyke playing Rob and Laura Petrie on one of the great shows of all time, The Dick Van Dyke Show. Everybody remembers the scene where Dick Van Dyke stumbles over the chair or the ottoman or whatever it is. And it's a wonderful, wonderful show with Maury Amsterdam and Rose Marie. And it's a great, great show. But in that, Mary Tyler Moore, which happened all the time in the 60s on sitcoms, much like the queen of sitcoms, Lucille Ball, she played a married woman with a child. Yep. And she put herself in certain situations and was rescued by her husband. That was the way those shows all worked. Nobody seemed to take offense at it. And by nobody, I mean I didn't. I was so young, I didn't know. I figured that was the way the world worked. But the world actually did change in the 1970s. The world actually did change for women, not for men. I mean, reactively it changed for men, but it really did change for women. And so the next show she was in, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, she played a committed career woman without a husband, without a child, with no particular prospects, who did not agonize over the fact that she didn't have a husband and she didn't have any children. No, she didn't do that at all. This is what she wanted. And the effect on women in this country was enormous. Tracy Roberts, who is the stage manager at the PTI show, said to me yesterday, and you can read, but Tracy's not the only one. You can read a lot of women saying the same thing. That, for me, changed my life. I realized, Tracy said, I could be in television, and I didn't have to be on camera. I could have the longer career. I could be in the production thing, and I could do this. When I started at Newsday as a sports writer in 1970, which is a very, very long time ago, the only women who worked in the sports section were secretaries. They didn't even have the glamorized title of executive assistant. They were secretaries. That's what they did. Well, that's what they got paid for. Actually, some of them ran the section, and they were right. better than everybody else. Yes. But that was the ceiling for them. They were secretaries. In that period of time, many of the really good colleges in America started admitting women. They used to be segregated. There was the Seven Sisters colleges that were often affiliated with the Ivy League schools that were all men. But everything sort of changed, and it wasn't just Betty Friedan, and it wasn't just Gloria Steinem, although they were at the top of the charts, Germaine Greer, people like that. But things changed, and women began to be much more aggressive and assertive. And so if you had a daughter, you know, you could see that she didn't just have to be a secretary. She didn't have to just worry about being married and having children and things like that. And some of the great talents in America were discovered. Too late for some, but right there for others. Leslie Visser, for example, got jobs that 10 years earlier she was not going to get. Jackie McMullen, jobs she was not 10 years before going to get. Sally Jenkins, people like that. Although Sally's a little bit younger than them. Mary Tyler Moore was symbolically extraordinarily important, and the show was great, and it wasn't a political harangue. It wasn't at all.
No.
They never even talked about these things. They totally accepted the Mary Richards character, and everybody remembers the characters. There were strong women all over the place, Rhoda and Phyllis and Georgette, and they were every bit as strong as Lou and Murray, even stronger than Murray, much stronger than Ted. Ted was a fool.
Right. He's a fool.
Ted Baxter was a fool.
He's the one that they made fun of.
All the time.
All the time.
Right.
All the time. So this show was extraordinarily important to the culture. And from that point on, all of the shows that had women and men, they had relatively equal stature in the shows. Like, you could watch a show like Cheers, and you would know that Kirstie Alley and Shelley Long were absolutely equal to Ted Danson.
Totally.
I mean, this was not even questioned. So this is a really big change in society.
Was the Archie Bunker show concurrent with Mary Tyler?
A little bit before.
That feels so anachronistic.
A little bit
now.
Before.
But they
That's
had
a Norman
to overlap.
Lear show.
Right?
They were, yeah, but it started.
So your suggestion is, so Mary Tyler Moore changed.
Mary Tyler Moore changed everything.
The Archie Bunker show predated Mary Tyler Moore.
By a couple of years.
Okay.
But the Mary Tyler Moore show changed all of these things socially and didn't beat you over the head with it. There's a movie that came out 20 years ago that was very funny called Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
It's a wonderful little movie. And in it, these girls have this debate. I don't want to be the Rhoda. I want to be the Mary. I want to be the Mary. This became very important in the culture as girls and women had the freedom of expression to say, this is exactly what I want to do, and I'm going to go do it. It took another generation for women to become incredibly aggressive and clawing, you know, like men were. But a lot of this is laid at the feet of the Mary Tyler Moore character, who's Mary Richards. What I find amusing in this, and she was in Michael Wilbon believes that Ordinary People is the greatest movie ever made.
It's got to be up there.
It's terribly depressing, and he believes it's the greatest movie ever. He believes that. What I find interesting is that when people, they're not eulogizing Mary Tyler Moore.
Mary Richards.
You're right.
We don't know Mary Tyler Moore.
Right.
We know Mary, it's Mary Richards.
Right.
That's the greatness of acting. It's your character. We have no idea who Mary Tyler
there
Moore is.
There's a statue in Minneapolis.
That's right.
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
seen
a statue on Nicollet
She's
Mall.
Throwing up the hat.
She's thrown up the hat. That is not Mary Tyler Moore. That's Mary Richards. That's the scene from the show.
I actually went back and watched the season one, about four or five episodes last night of the Mary Tyler Moore.
Great.
It's phenomenal.
It's great.
And that
they always have that line about you're spunky. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I hate spunk.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Edward Asner as Lou Grant. That's great.
And yes.
There were spinoffs. By the way, there were like five spinoffs.
Yeah, Phyllis, Rhoda, and
Lou.
And Lou. Yeah.
Was
Lou
Rhoda a spinoff of the Mary Tyler Moore show?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so, and Mary Tyler Moore show was a spinoff of the Dick Van Dyke?
No.
Different characters.
No.
Okay, so Mary Tyler Moore show was entirely original.
Yeah.
Entirely original.
Okay, got it.
And it's great how they handled her being single and her fine with that. The premiere, you know, she's got her old boyfriend comes to town and he's just awful. And she's like, yeah, you
get
know
out.
What? Get out.
Get out.
And she's fine with it. And you're like, this is a seminal moment. Yeah.
And in most of those shows, the female characters were always being encouraged to marry this one or date
yes.
this one and settle down. It's never happened to men. Nobody ever said to men, go get married, have some children, and settle down. Nobody ever said that. It was an enormous dichotomy in the way men and women were treated on television, which is expected to mirror and reflect society at large. So the Mary Richards character, big,
yes.
big deal. And that's why you're going to find today people of the ages of 50 plus are going to, women especially, are going to say, well, this is a, this was important to me.
On a related note, on the plane yesterday, I watched an episode where of Friends where Chandler and Joey get into quite a pickle.
Virtually the same thing.
Oh, my gosh.
I do want to say, you
that show's garbage.
You mentioned Ordinary People.
Hot, heated garbage.
There's another movie that she made later in her career called Flirting with Disaster.
The Ben Stiller movie.
Ben Stiller.
She's great.
That movie is terrific.
Phenomenal. Now, she's like the neurotic mother, and she's just
she did not have
tremendous.
Much of a movie career.
No.
She didn't
got,
want
she
it.
She got an Oscar nomination for Ordinary People.
Right.
She did well.
She was married for quite a while to Grant Tinker.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And they produced a million television shows. You'll read today that she had a variety of debilitating diseases and that she suffered from, everybody suffers from depression.
Alcoholism.
You always read that
right.
alcoholism and depression and all of that. But, and that I think is the point that when, like I saw Al Roker today and they had mentioned Mary Tyler Moore and they were saying that, that they were going to interview Candace Bergen, who played Murphy Brown,
right.
Who's an important character, but would never have been as important as Mary Richards. And Al Roker says, we're really going to miss her. Yeah, but we're missing Mary Richards.
You're missing a character.
We're missing Mary Richards. That, I think,
who else is a transformative character in television history?
Frasier
like that?
Crane, probably.
Really?
Well, he was on for so many years.
But
and
what did he transform?
Homer Simpson.
I mean,
no, he didn't.
Dr. Huxtable, like
yes.
that,
yeah.
that whole,
yes.
right?
Yeah. yeah, the Bill Cosby character
right.
in the Bill Cosby show. Yeah,
did
you're
you,
right about that.
I'm just looking, because you mentioned movies, I looked at her IMDb page. This is the greatest break-in to show. Do you know how she got into show business?
She was like an ad girl or something like
she
that,
was,
right?
Yes. Her first
dancing
break-in
elf?
Show.
Her legs
dancing
were shown
elf,
on
right?
Richard
Diamond
Show.
Was in 1955 as a dancing kitchen appliance.
Yeah.
Happy Hot Point. The Hot
who
Point
who
appliance
want that?
Elf.
Actually,
yeah.
How did Nigel know that?
Amazon.
Because I was.
That's true. You got called back for that Hot Point
I
appliance
didn't
elf.
Get it. You love this. I was reading all the columns written about her and things that she said. And she talked about being the symbol. She's like, I'm tired of this. I'm not a symbol. I don't want to be known as this. Except for when I go to a restaurant and the maitre d' doesn't know me and then I can't get a table. She's like, wait a minute. I'm a symbol. Give me a table.
This is important. Help your friends, crush
hurt
your
enemies
and get a good table at a restaurant. That's all it's about. But it really struck me that what we're going to, we don't know her.
What?
We don't really know her at all. It's not the same as a singer who's performing in front of you all the time, which in the character of whoever that person is. It's not, and they can hide a little bit, but acting is hiding. I mean, that's what it is. You yeah. inhabit somebody's lines and somebody's body, and that's what you are. And that character was so strong that is the identifiable moment. If you passed Mary Tyler Moore on the street 11 years ago, you might not
right.
have known who she was. But if she had the little hat and she was Mary Richards in the boots, you would say, oh, yeah. And there is. The statue's great.
It's awesome. Yeah.
The statue's great. It's in one of those walking malls in the middle of town in Minneapolis. So, okay. So I've gone on and on and on. And we will get to Brett Musburger later in the show. And we will get to Anne Hornaday when we come back. And I am Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the Blue Apron read. I really like Blue Apron. I'm going to encourage people to go get it and go do it and have fun chopping and dicing and cooking with one small caveat here.
Here we go.
No, you can't. if it's a three-pot situation, you need another person. You know, you need to probably hire someone
to come
over. You
only got two hands.
Because you only have two hands.
Yeah, or just go to Chad's.
You work in two pots. You can go to Chad's. It'd be great if Blue Apron supplied all of our food. But I've done this I like it. I'm going to do it again. I'm just not doing it this week, but I am going to do it again. It is, it's affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. There's variety. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year. You'll never get bored. It's flexible. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs. And there's no weekly commitment. You only get deliveries when you want them. And it's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. When the stuff is delivered to your house, it comes in one of those real cold boxes, you know, with dry ice or whatever is in there. And they have these little bags, and the bags are labeled knickknacks for this particular meal. There's nothing that isn't in there. Nothing.
Knickknacks and paddywhacks?
Yeah. It plates aren't in there.
They assume that's you have olive oil, salt, and pepper.
Yeah.
Okay. Whoa.
If you don't,
what are those exotic spices?
I'm sorry, what? If you like shallots, this is your deal.
Right.
It's guaranteed. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they will make it right. You can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TonyK. That Andy perked up at free. He loved that. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. That is blueapron.com/TonyK. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. It is. It's good. It's great fun.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Oh, we like this already. We like this already.
That's right.
This is Randy Russell. His band is called East Kin, K-I-N, Kin. The song is called A Lot on My Plate. Michael, if people want to send original music.
Hold on. Use that microphone. I've switched the cables.
What happened?
I plugged the wrong cables.
Were you just waving your hands madly like an NFL ref? What are you doing?
He always tries to
setting everything. Michael, if people want to send their original music for us, how do they do it?
They can email jingles at tonykornheiser.com and please read the fine print.
Yeah. We'll play it for you. Ann Hornaday joins us now, and this is going to be, you know, because Jeannie's not here, Ann does not have an ally in the room at the moment. And I've got four movies that I have seen in the last 5 days.
Uh-oh.
Moonlight, Fences, Manchester by the Sea, and Arrival. So we're going to wait a second or two. We're going to ask you about the Oscars and who got left out and who surprised you. And then I'm going to review all of these movies, and you're going to say, no, you're wrong. Okay, and that's how it's going to proceed.
I've walked into a trap.
No, it's no trap. I'm letting you know. If it was a trap, I would just spring it on you. So, first of all, let's start your general feeling about the Oscar nominations.
General feeling was pretty good, you know. Like, I didn't see any major... I mean, when we talk about Arrival, I was shocked that Amy Adams got shut out.
Yeah, okay.
Because that movie got so many nominations, and she literally carried... I mean, it was like...
She's the movie.
She's the movie, so it's kind of like, loved the movie, except for the actual person who carried
it. She is the movie.
On her shoulders.
Yeah.
So that was... And I feel like they... you know, it's like Meryl Streep. I mean, okay, I don't think she needed this nomination this year for that performance.
Right.
I think that should have gone to Amy Adams, but I don't know. I don't really have any major. I don't really think I have any major. You know, some of the documentaries. I had a couple of documentaries I loved this year that I would have liked to have seen. Although I think most of them are. You know, I don't quibble with many of them, but you know, I would have liked to have seen. There were two documentaries: one called Tower, one called Camera Person. That I might have put into that Life Animated slot, but, you know, look, I'm here to love. I mean, I'm all about the love.
What about Tom Hanks, who lately seems to be being ignored, even though he is quite possibly, you know, the finest American actor out there with the greatest range? And I know you really liked Sully.
I did.
You really liked Tom Hanks. And I thought he should have won an Oscar for Captain Phillips. And now he's not even nominated. And he wasn't nominated the year before. Is there some sense of we're sick of Tom Hanks?
No, it's look... I don't pick up those vibes at all. If you know, it's weird to talk about like slots because I don't actually believe in that. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that Hacksaw Ridge took the Sully slot in a way. You know,
right? Because Mel Gibson's a fine human being, and Tom Hanks isn't.
I Yeah, exactly.
Insane.
It's like, I don't know why they responded. I mean, Hacksaw Ridge is a really powerful story, but so is Sully, and yeah. I think Sully's a better piece of filmmaking.
Landed
frankly.
The plane and saved 155 lives. Other
Just
than that,
that
who
you
needs
call that? You know, on your on a typical Tuesday afternoon. But yeah. You raise a good point. I think I would have much rather gone. I would have gone for Sully absolutely. Way over Hacksaw Ridge.
Okay, I have another question, too, and this is mindful of your A1 piece yesterday.
Oh.
And Oscar So White from the year before. And as we know, these movies that are being nominated this year were all either done or in production
exactly.
by this time last year. So it isn't like, oh, my God, we
exactly.
have responded.
This is not a response, exactly.
But this is these things were in the pipeline, but this is my question. Do you think now there is an opportunity for a response in the voting? Do you think the voting this year will be, we want to show that we are not Oscars so
no.
white, so we will bend over backwards to move this
no.
on the individual voting? No?
You know,
really,
listen,
Hollywood?
Maybe I'm naive. I mean, you're asking somebody who's literally like 3,000 miles away from the people in question. I don't know the Academy. I don't know very many Academy members. I mean, it's...
Hello, gorgeous. You don't think
exactly.
that the people in Malibu... Are you really?
Okay.
Okay.
You know, I try to keep an arm's length. It's like, you know, it's like a friend of mine, a publicist friend once said, make yourself comfortable, but don't put your feet up.
Okay.
In
okay.
terms of your relationship with the, you know, it's like I am not friendly with, and honestly, but to the degree that I do talk to them in the course of my reporting and bumping into them at festivals and things, I think when it comes to voting, they really, really genuinely want to reward quality. I mean, they really genuinely reward excellence and what they think is excellent. Now, I happen to think this year that that will pan out into a very inclusive looking night. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I think it's Viola Davis's year.
She's
hands
great.
Down.
She is great.
And they're going to vote for her because of that performance and because of
yeah.
her, not because they're trying to check a box. So I'd like to give them a little bit more credit
okay.
than that. I really don't. I mean, we'll see. I hope that, I mean, my one concern is that because La La Land got so many nominations, and you and I both love that movie. I'm not, you
it's
know.
It's a great time. It's a great time.
Not casting asparagus, but I really hope that they can spread the love around a little bit. Like, I hope all those nominations don't indicate some kind of sweep that just A, makes for a boring night, and B, you know, I just like I really do hope that Moonlight gets a couple. Like, I hope that Mahershala Ali, you know,
he's great.
Who is great?
He's great.
And again, that's not because of any box checking. That's because
no,
that
great.
Is a very powerful, nuanced performance. And I'd love to see Barry Jenkins, the director, get something for his screenplay or direction. So, you know, again, not in the interest of, you know, any kind of ethnic, diversity initiative, but really just to kind of reward a lot of really good work.
Okay, so let me go step by step on these movies. And you mentioned Moonlight, and I'm going to get to Moonlight first.
Mm-hmm.
I really admire Moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great piece of work. I'm not sure it's a great film, but I know it's a great piece of work.
What's the difference, do you think?
Well, for me personally, it is the lasting quality. It is something that I, when I talk to friends about or anybody else, say I am completely emotionally involved. I had the same reaction to Moonlight that I had to Boyhood.
Yeah.
I really appreciated it. I could not relate to it.
Okay.
I just could not. I think the performances, it's a three-part movie. For people who don't know this, it's a three-part movie, three stages in the life of this particular fellow. And the third one, I didn't even know it was the same guy for the first 10 minutes in the third. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? I really didn't. Because he so clearly wanted to look like the father figure that he never had
yes.
in the first act. That took me a while. And that
yeah.
is, could you pronounce his first name again? Because that's the great performance.
I think it's Mahershala Ali.
It's fantastic. That guy's great.
He is magnificent.
And it's one of these things that I felt like I did with Boyhood that I really admire it.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize how good it is. And I recognize these performances and that these are nobody you've ever seen before. And you are completely in the boat with them.
Yeah.
But I don't, it's so different than my own personal life that
right.
I just, you know. So from
okay.
afar, I admire it, didn't love it. Really
Got
liked it.
It,
didn't love it. Fences,
it.
And now we're going to go through Fences. Viola Davis has to win because she's that good.
Totally with
but
you.
I have the same criticism of this that I have of a movie like doubt or proof or any stage play. Any tightly constructed stage play. What happens in a stage play, because you don't have nuance in stage plays. You don't. Your dialogue has to work at a much higher level. It has to be louder. The points have to be made. Mm-hmm. The supporting characters are not even characters sometimes. They're just symbols. Mm-hmm. And when you put this on a screen, it's tough to widen out. And what you get is a lot of shouting and a lot of anger. And for me, that's an angry stage to me. The performances, Viola Davis should win, Denzel Washington absolutely should be nominated and all of that. Mm-hmm. But where it fails for me is the same. It's not as bad as August Osage County. It's not
exactly.
As that.
I know, which will always go down in history as the worst.
It's just awful. But in this particular case, when you're done, you're saying, well, I'm glad that's over. Because it's not a movie. It's not a movie. It's a play.
It's a filmed play, right.
It's a play. So, okay, so are you're not yelling at me. You haven't yelled at me.
Well, I don't know if you want me. When do
go.
I come in? I don't know.
Are you go, both.
I need a cue.
No.
I need, Mr. Weatherwax.
Yeah.
I take your point, and I agree that I think what Denzel Washington did when he directed this was decide he doesn't open it up. I mean, I think he opens it up a teeny bit. Like you see a scene on a street, you see a scene in a bar, but really, he keeps it to that backyard.
He respects the play. And
I would agree with you, but I would agree with you that it's only, quote-unquote, a staged play, except that in this case, I actually think that choice was appropriate, because this is a man who is hemmed in. He's hemmed in by his history.
And the title. Yes, sure.
And the title.
Yeah.
The metaphor title. And so I think it's kind of a container for this ferocity that is just barely able to be contained by both the screen, you know, the frame, and the setting. So I utterly take your point, but I do think in this case that constraint works. And I think sometimes I agree with you. I wouldn't put this. I'm gratified that it's getting the attention that the nominations bring it, because I think it's worth seeing. If only to just bring, you know, they originally did this on Broadway, Viola Davis.
And they won everything, and they should.
But this is kind of a chance for people to see something that they wouldn't have been able to see
otherwise.
But I mean,
the point I'm making...
Is it a great piece of cinema, you know, in a cinematic, like in terms of cinematic boundaries being broken or new language being discovered? No. But it's you know, sometimes movies are just vectors to bring something to a wider audience that would never have had the chance, and I honestly think it's worth it. And I think it's, you know, and like you, I mean, unlike you, I wasn't glad. I mean, I was so glad I saw it. I just was so thinking, like,
I think people should see it. I do.
Amazing. And I wasn't, but I didn't have that feeling of, like, God, I'm glad that's over. I just was like, wow.
It's rough.
I've just been in the presence of something really powerful.
But that's rough. That's a rough play.
That's
not a funny play. That's a rough play. And what the other point I was making, the Michael T. Williamson character, he's just a symbol. I mean, he's Gabriel the angel. That's all he is.
I totally agree with you on that one. So, yeah, but that's the writing, though, isn't it?
I know. And that's why I like to go see plays when they're plays. And I'm not sure I like to go see them as movies.
I totally am with you.
Though people should see it.
Not all of us have that chance.
It's like Moonlight. Absolutely go see it. Absolutely go see it. It's really good. And in the case of anybody like me, you've never seen anything like this before. This is not a part of the world you've ever
seen.
Well,
and unlike Fences, I think Moonlight really is cinema with the capital C. I think that there's like a cinematic language and
a
visual
ending.
Language that's go. And I think that's what you were getting at when you say you admired it. I think you're same with Boyhood. These are things that are just formally sophisticated, like they are really elevating the art form.
It's really worth seeing. It's really nuanced, and it has a great ending. It's perfect.
What, Moonlight?
Yes, it's perfect.
Oh, that scene is one of the
It's perfect.
That scene is one of the all-time great. No. Oh my god. And we're going to talk about Manchester, which also has one of the
No, we're getting to this now. We're getting to this now. Manchester by the Sea.
Please don't diss it.
I've been waiting for this.
Manchester by the Sea. I don't want to give too much away in the movie.
Yeah, I won't allow you.
But I'm going to tell you that in the first half of the movie, maybe even at the end of the first third of the movie, something happens in this movie where you go, oh, my God.
Yes. That's
and true. From that moment on, even though to get to that point seems to have taken 6 years
it's
off
so
your life,
slow.
When it gets to that point, you have to make the following decision. Am I in or am I out? You have to quit right now, or you have, and in my case, I had watched to that point from the vantage point that I like to watch movies, standing by my sink, eating. That happened. I went, oh, my God, and made the decision, okay, I'm in. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to go the whole way.
Wow.
It is one of the bleakest things I have ever seen. The character played by Casey Affleck is his so shattered. Yes. This person is so shattered. He is incapable often of language.
Oh.
His the emotional range in this. I'm not an acting professor. But he's in a. You think Denzel Washington's in a box? Guy's in a straitjacket. He's an emotional straitjacket.
Yeah.
When it was over, and I actually did like the end of it, and I will say that the kid, the young man who plays the kid in this, is terrific.
Yeah. He's great.
He's terrific. Yeah. Although all he wants to do is make out with every girl.
Wow. That
he's a teenage boy.
But that movie, when you're done with that movie, you say this: I will never watch this movie again. Never. I'm not saying it's terrible, Ann. I'm saying that you go through. I'm done.
The scene with Michelle Williams and Casey Affleck at the end.
Yes, at the end.
And Ann knows my views on the movie. That is one of the most. And I know it's fiction, and I'm watching it knowing that this is a made-up story. That is one of the most emotionally wrenching things I have experienced in years, including in my regular normal life.
Sink.
Exactly, and that's when I saw it at a screening. It was just me and a couple of publicists, and it was that scene where, like, all pretense. I just started crying, sobbing. I just was sobbing openly. I mean, it's like, okay, I'm done trying to fake it. I am going to sob. I mean, I had a lump in my throat up until then, but that's when I let loose. And that's the scene. That and the last scene of Moonlight are both just magnificent. And I do want to see it again, just because if we could pull back from the rent, you know. Yes, it's. I am not going to disagree on any of what you said, because how can I? I mean, of course, it's wrenching and harrowing, and it's you're watching somebody in such deep pain. But can I just please add that there is humor. I mean, the stuff with the teenagers is so funny and so observant in terms of the way teenagers act. And also just those efforts of the, you know, this guy goes back to his hometown to help his nephew out, and these women all want to help. Like, a lot of these single moms kind of perk up when he comes to town, and they kind of want to get with him, and
he can't.
His cluelessness can't, and kind of like, that's kind of funny. You got to admit, like, those there. It's not like it's just all bad, bad news but I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. I mean,
do you know how many times I wanted the boat to sink
movie
could end?
But also, as a writer, what I'm fascinated by, this is why I do want to see it again. And I guess this is just some people just, you know, like, I'm not going to tie you to a chair and make you watch it, but think for people that are interested in such things, the way that Kenneth Lonergan, the writer and director, doles out the information, I mean, just structurally, it's a fascinating film to me in terms of the way he reveals this character, and also the way he gets him to a certain point and no further, and he won't give you that kind of easy gratification of, like, oh, everything's fine, and I'm cured, and I'm healed, and it's like,
no.
I think it's really interesting.
That's true.
Like,
no, they walk the road they're supposed to walk.
It's grief. Yeah. I mean, it's grief.
Unlike Fences, there's no sunlight at the end.
Yeah. No, and there's no kind of fat, like, unlike, there aren't those kind of theatrical devices. I just think he's a very disciplined writer and a very disciplined filmmaker, and that interests me. And he always gives these actors absolute, just the best canvas to give the best performance. I mean, even Matthew Broderick, you know, who's in one scene.
It's weird in the movie.
But they're always so good. It's just like there's something so, like when I interviewed Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams about Lonergan, Michelle Williams said, you know, you read these scripts and it's like you're eavesdropping. I mean, they are so naturalistic. They're so true to life. But yet they're just heightened enough to make it compelling. Like, it made you want to come away from the refrigerator.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is a real, that's a subtle, subtle talent.
All right.
Anyway.
I'm getting to Arrival. I've taken too much time. I'm being very quick on Arrival.
Okay.
In the words of Vince Lombardi, what the hell is going on here?
Baby.
By the end of Arrival.
What in the frickity frack?
Right. By the end of Arrival, when I finally have pieced it together and I understand a little bit about Amy Adams' character and what is going on with the notion of time.
Now, we really can't talk about this.
I know. But it's not, you know what, it's not for me.
Okay.
It's not for me. And I loved Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Interesting.
And I just, at the end of it, I just went, really? Is that what happened?
Oh.
Really?
See, I was very affected by it. You know, it's funny. I saw that at Toronto along with La La Land, and it kind of messed me up a little bit.
Because you had a heptapod fixation or
heptapods
something like that?
Heptapods always make me cry.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah,
it's just... Now, what are we going to do about Hell and High Water for you?
I haven't seen it yet.
We
I have it.
We have to do something about this, Tony.
I have
it's
it.
A big problem. You have... Now
I'm
going
to see
really
it.
I'm in a position
I just
to wrote, say,
I just saw four in 5 days.
You have to see this movie.
I will. I'll see Hell or High Water.
You're going to love it.
No, I'm sure I'm going to love it. I'm sure I'm going to love it. But see, all of these movies...
You're good. You're doing
La La
well,
Land
you're
was
really...
better for me than all of these movies. Not by a lot.
I hear you.
But La La Land, these movies, I needed the escape of La La Land after these movies. That's what's good about La La Land to me.
All right, here's what I'm going to tell you to do. Here's what the doctor orders. I'm going to prescribe one dose of Hell or High Water and one dose of Hidden Figures to make you feel like everything's great.
Good. All right. Thank you, Ann.
It's always a pleasure.
Ann Hornaday, boys and girls. That was a long time, but I'd seen the movies. And you know what? We don't have a clock here. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. Nigel will do news when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find qualified and quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Tony. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Tony. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Tony.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show. Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Brandon Bowker, singer-songwriter, Louisville, Kentucky. Song is called Hold On. He's an actual musician.
Yeah, he's very
talented. I mean, a lot of the people that send us stuff are actual musicians.
Yes, they really are.
I'm not an actual musician.
No, you tried, though.
No, I'm terrible.
Was it piano that you tried to take?
Adult piano lessons.
Yes. Adult.
I think that that's very cool. I mean, I would like to do that.
I stunk. I gave it up.
How long did you go for?
4 or 5 months.
And just nothing?
No, I was lousy. I'm tone deaf, and I just was.
You're also not patient.
I'm
that doesn't ring true.
Same guy?
No. All right, Michael, how do people send us stuff?
They can email jingles at tonykornheisershow.com.
And not only that, but if you want to buy stuff, like Bobby Snyder walked in today wearing a Tony Kornheiser Show.
It's a great looking
T-shirt.
Impressive show.
That I had never seen just live before. Yes. I thought it was really, really nice. Michael,
I can buy you one.
If people want to get the gear, how do they do it?
They can go to shop.tonykornheisershow.com, and there is currently a ladies' shirt that is coming soon.
Be good for me.
When you say there's currently a lady shirt that is coming soon, well, that's a mixed message.
Well, it's visible on the site, so it's currently available for you to pre-order.
I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, okay.
All caps, coming soon.
That's really good.
There you go.
So you know it's coming.
Well, that was a tough decision, all caps.
It's got to be, yeah.
We have
of course.
Who is our designer? Should we plug our designer?
Our designer is Jeff Jones, who's been doing
not
great work.
Not that Jeff Jones.
Also an ODU.
Not the basketball
great
coach.
Work at ODU.
He's working on a new design for us as we do the show.
Fantastic. You have news?
I do. Tiger Woods will be back today. 1:40 Eastern is when he tees off.
So it takes about 4.5 to 5 hours to complete a round. So that means that we won't get it in PTI.
Too. No, you won't.
No,
he's playing with Dustin Johnson
and Jason Day.
Jason Day.
So here's the thing.
He's going to be out hit, Barry.
But yeah, he's going to be. Well, Michael and I talked about this yesterday, and Michael's superior knowledge of the course convinced me that he won't be hitting in first every time. But what I think is striking about the pairing, the grouping, is we've reached a shift. It used to be like, oh my gosh, who's playing with Tiger? How are those people going to be affected? Now it's like, oh my gosh, who is Tiger playing with? How is Tiger going to be affected by the bomber, Dustin Johnson, and one of the best players in the world, Jason Day?
So Tiger said he loves... Tiger, yesterday, Roger Goodell said it would be an honor to hand the Super Bowl trophy to Tom Brady.
Which did is he a, say that or Sean
which
Spicer?
Is an eight Pinocchio situation.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can only
I'm
go to four.
I'm thrilled to do this job to which I have obligated.
So Tiger said how fabulous it is to play with Jason Day and Dustin Johnson, and your thoughts on that are?
Well, again, it's a role reversal. I mean,
do you believe him?
I think that he has to be open to being a star and being Tiger Woods and not being one of those guys who gets shuffled to the 7:30 a.m. tee time before the galleries gets. Yeah. He's never going to be the third wheel in a threesome because of 14 majors and everything he's been through and the only worldwide star the sport has.
Michael, you've played Torrey Pines.
I have played Torrey Pines.
Your thoughts about length and what that means on that course.
So we've had a cold and rainy last 2 weeks in La Jolla, so it's actually going to be dry and sunny for the next couple of days, but we still have highs that are only going to reach in the mid to high 50s today, getting to the low 70s by the weekend, and you have all that sea air because this is right on the Pacific Ocean. So you have two guys, Jason Day and Dustin Johnson, who their best club happens to be their driver, and you're going to take that out of their hands a little bit because you have a heavier air and you have a grass that's not going to run as much as you might have in, say, the Southeast.
Can I ask a golf question of you guys? He said, I heard the interview of him this morning, and he said, I'm really good friends with those two guys. Is
not
that
true?
Okay.
Can't be true.
I mean, this is an hour-long discussion on what friends mean to Tiger and what and what his relationships are and the depth of his relationships. He does consider people he knows in passing and by face and who might exchange words for a few minutes, friends. And it's my belief that he doesn't have a real deep understanding of what a true friendship is.
And Dustin Johnson has things rolling around in his head. So
yes, he does.
He's not.
Mostly tumbleweeds.
Yeah, he's not.
And historically, Tiger looks to the older generation as to those who he would become friends in our traditional sense.
Marco. I mean, you know, Omira, the guy that when Tiger was in his early 20s, he kind of friended up because that's who he related with. Jason Day admired, as everybody of Jason Day's generation admired Tiger from afar. They're just not peers. They're not peers in where they are in their career now. They're not peers in how they play. It's just this kind of this whole thing of Tiger saying, like, I miss the guys.
Yeah, that doesn't ring true.
No, that's just not. He's never been one of the guys.
No, he couldn't be.
Right? In his whole life.
They all should be tithing to him. He made them all rich.
And I think they do. And that's their respect. And even Phil, there's been a pivot with how Phil talks about Tiger in the last 4 or 5 years when Tiger hasn't been relevant. There is that appreciation and acknowledgement of we're all way better off because of what you did and who you were.
It's interesting because, like, the friendships he has, which maybe is the case of anyone who's famous, that famous at that age and as famous as he became, is like the Nota Begays of the world who are like, hey, good work, Tiger.
Well,
hey, you're the man, Tiger.
Okay, but that would have been that friendship. Okay, so that one I think is different. Like, that was formed at a time when, yes,
that was formed when they were kids
exactly.
in junior tournaments,
exactly.
and Tiger was the only golfer of color that Nota Begay could see
Correct.
On a golf course.
Oh, interesting.
Correct.
Okay.
So that one I think is real.
Friendship.
And that's why he is essentially a public relations expert for Tiger Woods whenever he goes.
Like
he
spokesman.
Loves him. Well, he loves
yeah,
him.
Yeah, right.
And he should.
But he also gets information.
Yeah.
He can get information from Tiger that other people can't get.
Tiger using TaylorMade, is that a surprise? He can't use Nike because you can't get replacements anymore. Nike's out of business in the club business. Is that a surprise on any level?
No, I mean, that's what he carried in the Bahamas. The Bahamas, I think, when he played in November, December.
But a Titleist putter.
Yeah, he's always going to use that Scotty Cameron, I think, now. I'm not an equipment junkie. I mean,
so
he's got to hit some
The big thing is that he was one of the last golfers to go to the modern driver, which would be the 460cc high face driver where you can hit it high off the toe, which is why these guys can carry it so far with a fade. He always used a slightly smaller driver, and if you looked at the way he tried to hit, he hit it down a little bit, and he actually put a little bit too much spin. So that's why.
So it didn't roll.
It was one reason why if he played head to head against Rory, and he would carry it the same distance. Rory's ball would release 30 to 40 yards, and his ball would check up.
Huh.
So that actually helps him at a place like Torrey because it could keep him out of the rough. I think today when you see him play, he's going to play a lot of bunt drivers, is what he would call it, a lot of three woods. and he's going to set up a lot of five irons, six irons into these tough greens. And the big thing is with the short game where he struggled so much the last couple of years, I know this is where he had the chipping yips a year ago, but you have a thick rye grass for the rough right around the greens, which allows him to open up the face and play a chop down shot, which is easier for him to control with the rollout than a low nip shot right off the fairway, where he has to really chip.
That's where he had the nip,
Bottom of the arc.
What would you? We're going to have Steve Sands on tomorrow, who'll talk about looking back on today's round.
Actually, it's Michael Sands. Is that
Steve Sands is who we want. Michael Sands for other things.
It's a booking problem.
What would be good
today?
Yeah, what would be good?
I mean, one under is somewhere. Also, I think there's a relative to the two guys he's playing with. I mean, you're playing with the U.S. Open champion and you know a number one player in the world. How does he fit in there? It's nicer because when he played in the Bahamas in his own event, it was an 18 player field. You can't tell relative things with 18. You know, this is a full field event. It's a place that he is enormously comfortable. That he has one of his signature moment and then wins. How many times has he won there? Seven times on the PGA
Tour? He's won eight times, but he says nine because he includes his World Junior there.
Okay, fine. So we'll splice that differently. I think that a number under par is good today as long as DJ and Jason Day don't shoot 64s.
You agree with that?
I agree with 71. You look at he's starting on the South course, which is the U.S. Open course, right, and he has the North course tomorrow. So if he needs to make a move or if he's feeling comfortable, I think that course sets it up, even though it has been rerouted by Weisskopf, I think, this past year or so.
Do you understand any of that? That
was
really good.
No. I just feel like the rye grass should be on the golf channel.
Michael's level of discourse may alienate people on the golf channel. Like, it's deep.
We haven't even gotten into the rye around the greens.
No, so the big thing to watch is the Poana greens, because a lot of golfers
hate
Poana.
Because Poana flowers in the afternoon, particularly with the mist coming off the ocean.
This is actually true.
But golfers who grow up on Poana, like Southern California golfers like Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, love it because it has the truest break.
So you grew up on Poana.
I did. Columbia. That's why I love putting on Poana greens.
It's not mist, by the way. I believe it's a marine layer is how they describe
it
out there. Yes.
Yeah,
marine layer.
Yes. What else do you have? What do you have to say?
Not much.
Hard to follow that. Hoyas win.
The Hoyas win.
That guy is Rich Shavatkin. Is my president.
Yeah, we love Rich. They take out number 16, Creighton, 71 to 51.
I don't think that's how you say it.
By 20. I think it is.
You said Creighton.
Yes.
Creighton.
By 20.
Well, Creighton, as you like to pronounce it.
Creighton doesn't seem right.
Is without injured point guard Maurice Watson Jr. So they obviously were struggling. And this is just easily the biggest win for the Hoyas.
Easily.
In a couple of years, right?
Last year they had a couple of good wins in there. Here's your Big East standings, by the way. Villanova, Butler, Creighton, Marquette, Xavier, St. John's, Seton Hall, Providence. Georgetown climbs out of the cellar last night,
DePaul,
2-6, DePaul. And DePaul is 1-6.
I like to call
ghost program.
I like to call Georgetown the new DePaul.
Right.
Yeah.
So they win. George Washington wins. They beat George Mason, 87-68. I know you were interested in that game as well, Mr. Tony.
I paid a lot of tuition to George Washington, so I hope they do well.
You're happy they win.
I hope they do well.
1984, The Immortal Book by George Orwell is soaring back to the top of the charts. It's number one on Amazon.com, and the publisher has ordered an additional 75,000 copies. This is all on the heels of Kellyanne Conway's reference to alternate facts.
Michael, did you teach...
I did teach that book. I think you're referring to
Double Think
from the book. So it's actually a book that's been going out of favor in high schools because it's a very, I would say it's a dense read. It is basically a political treatise that is stuck in six pages in between a 300-page novel. So it's a little hard for high school kids to follow right now. But if you have not read it or have not read it recently, I very much recommend it right now. And I think we're all in this phase of 2 minutes of hate as we are trying to, you know, get through this frenzy.
When I was in high school, the books that you had to read, there were other books, but of this genre were 1984 and Brave New World.
Right.
And those were the two that you had to read. Are they still teaching Brave New World?
Both of those have been relegated to summer reading at very traditional high schools. But again, those two books have been pushed aside a little bit.
As have I.
Last Shot, I think, a Final Four mystery is now must reading for most.
high school
programs. Well, it's so painful to me that what is the book that Liz loved so much?
Oh,
was it
the Last Amateurs?
Last Amateurs.
Last Amateurs. You know, yeah.
Those gallant basketball players.
It's about the Patriot League, right?
Liz wrote her high school application essay on that book as her favorite book.
Wow.
Did Barry go to Duke?
I think he might have. Hmm. I have an interesting story for you.
Barry's mic just dropped out.
What do you got?
I have an interesting story for you out of Las Vegas, Mr. Tony. There was a Korean restaurant by the name of Club Yamang. Right? And it was very successful. Then all of a sudden, Homeland Security investigators raided it and detained its employees for hour-long interrogations. They said this is all at the behest of an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent, ICE, as we like to know them. It turns out that agent,
Issei,
a bloke by the name of Joo-hoon David Lee, was actually in cahoots with a rival Korean restaurant called Club Sonaji.
David Lee, the guy who played for the Celtics and the Warriors?
I think it's a different bloke.
Okay.
I think it's a different bloke. So this guy basically was in that restaurant, Club Sonaji, and they said, hey, listen, can you just harass those guys and drive them out of business? And in return, he would get thousands of – he would comped everything he ate and drank
there. Why is this bad?
Well, because he's a federal agent, and you're not supposed to do this sort of thing.
Do you know the number one attraction of coaching at Las Vegas for years and years and years, and why it was said that Rolly Massimino took the job at Vegas at one point? Because you got what was called the pencil, and you were able to sign for everything, everywhere in Las Vegas. You never paid for anything. The pencil.
I'm sure Jerry Tarkanian didn't take advantage of
that. He never paid for anything.
What?
And by the way, if the basketball team was good at that point in time, that was the civic treasure in sports.
Right.
And if you're going to pay, the University of West Virginia is going to give Bob Huggins $25,000 additional for every single time he beats Kansas, and you don't jump up and scream about how coarse and crass that is, why wouldn't you think that the pencil in Las Vegas is a great thing?
That's the way they got you there. That Huggins money does go to charity.
I saw that later.
It's the Bob Huggins.
When did that happen?
I walked out of here yesterday. We had talked about that, and that didn't it bubble up later, Michael?
Did it happen because it had?
I don't know.
Did it achieve this level of public knowledge that people said this is awful?
I would hope that would be the case.
Yeah. Call that the
charity might
effect.
Be his own pencil.
That's fine. All right, you done?
I am done.
Great. So we will come back with Old Guy, and in the Old Guy segment, I will talk about Brent Musburger, and others will join. Others will join because everybody. That is the voice that one of the voices that is indelibly stamped on the history of American sports is Brent Musburger's. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
It's a sports show, so we're doing the SeatGeek read. SeatGeek is the smart way to buy and sell tickets for live events. Super Bowl is here. It's a can't-miss experience. If you can get tickets through SeatGeek, by all means do it. But you can also use SeatGeek to find the best deals on tickets to NBA and NHL games, college basketball, and concerts. With SeatGeek, you always get the best deal on every ticket because SeatGeek price compares for you by searching multiple ticket sites. Prices can vary on where you shop, but SeatGeek will always find you the lowest available price. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. So you will immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Plus, every ticket you buy on SeatGeek is backed by their 100% guarantee. You can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Best of all, listeners to this fine podcast get a $20 rebate off of their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, first, you download the SeatGeek app. That's SeatGeek. Second, you go to the settings tab and you click on add a promo code. And when that comes up, the promo code you add, third thing you have to do, is Tony, T-O-N-Y. And then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first purchase. So download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code Tony today.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Old Guy Radio for the day. These are the Four Seasons. Before they were Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, they were just the Four Seasons. This is Walk Like a Man. This was their second or third big song after Sherry. Sherry was the number one song that they ever had. And this is second or third after that. This entered the charts 53 years ago. Very few people in this room were alive 53 years ago. I was already 30. They're a great group in terms of critical commentary. Obviously, they're a great group. I'm a Beach Boys fan and an Eagles fan. But I think that if you wrote the history of music in the country, you would say that the Four Seasons were the best-selling and biggest group ever. I think the Supremes and the Four Seasons would probably get that in terms of boy groups and girl groups. Great. Everything about them depended on Frankie Valli's voice, which has been described many times as a dog whistle falsetto. And nobody could do it. Except now when you see Jersey Boys, everybody can do it. Everybody can do it.
Yep.
Every high school in America has somebody doing Frankie Valli. It's amazing. Nobody could do it then, and they can all do it now. I saved time for Brent Musburger, and this is going to – it's not going to take a while, but everybody in here has experience with Brent Musburger. In the pantheon of American play-by-play guys, okay, don't tell me about John Madden because he wasn't a play-by-play guy. I'm going to talk just about play-by-play guys. In a period stretching from the mid to late 70s all the way to the early 2000s, the A-list is four people. It's just four people. It's Brent Musburger, it's Al Michaels, it's Keith Jackson, and it's Pat Summerall. That's it. That's the list. And you're going to say, well, Vin Scully did baseball. Baseball is not the national sport that football is. You do basketball. No. You have to do pro or college football or both. You have to do that because that's what everybody tunes into. And those are the voices that are on top of the mountain. There are some very great people who also did this. They're just not there. And I'm not talking about Joe Buck now, and I'm not talking about Jim Nance because they're after. They don't start as far back as Musburger starts. Why do I like Musburger? Why? Because he's got a great voice and because he did something so important in television. Wherever he was, that was the big game. If Brent Musburger this year had done a game between Tennessee and Jacksonville and you tuned in, you would believe it was the precursor to the Super Bowl. He delivered that. Everybody knows. From CBS, when he started on the NFL Today with Brent and Irv and Phyllis, mm-hmm. which was a groundbreaking show in sports because of Phyllis and because of Irv more so than Brent. But Brent was the show. Brent, it would open up. You are looking live. That's that phrase alone. I mean, Al Michaels is known for a call that he made. You know, do you believe in miracles? And Al's great. Al's a good friend. I love Al. But Brent was known for the repetitive notion of you are looking live. He had just a fantastic, fantastic voice. Andy is older than Chris and older than Barry. You go back to the beginning of Brent's career.
I was saying while the show was going on that I believe his first CBS assignment was the Bullets Warriors 1975 finals with Rick Barry and the sweep. And I think he did it with Oscar Robertson, who just retired. That's the first time I heard his name. And then I think a year or so later came the NFL Today.
And that show, that was not even a game. And everybody watched that show.
Well, the part of the boat was Jimmy the Greek.
Yeah, exactly.
And he couldn't get point spreads and was actually pushed by Roselle because he understood that gambling was a big part of why people watched.
It was the big part.
And the checklist that he had was to give you an idea. Yeah, you might go with those points or you may not go with those points. And then the great Brent and the Greek encounter was in a bar. They were fighting over Phyllis George, and I think Brent decked him.
Yeah, punched him in the head.
Yeah.
One of my favorite Al Michaels, by the way, is how Michael slyly gets in betting stuff
into
the game.
Brent
makes me happy.
Brent doesn't do it slyly. No, he says, hey, Clemson,
Clemson giving three here.
Yeah. At the end of games, Brent said, you can't let him score now.
Right.
Because it's going to be 10.
This looks like a backdoor cover, folks.
But the you are looking live thing, and I think one of the reasons why this is an appropriate time for him to step aside is, okay, so he'd kind of been relegated to the SEC network. There was a gravity to the you are looking live at, as you said, the big game. And when all of a sudden it's, you know, he's doing Vanderbilt Ole Miss, it's not an appropriate setting for a guy of that stature and how he presented himself.
He's still great.
Oh, yeah.
He is still great. I mean, I thought... And this is no knock on Sean McDonough, because I think Sean McDonough is really, really good. But when that came available, I thought, go to Brent.
Except you're not going to do that with like a five. You want that to be how long
a run,
right?
Yeah, it would not have been a long run.
I don't think Brent ever did NFL play-by-play. I don't think he ever did a game. Because,
really? Yeah, because he always is in the...
He did college.
College, and when he left CBS... Or
he didn't leave CBS.
They left him, yeah.
He got fired.
Yeah, he got fired.
I think it was in 1989 or 1990 or something
It was April Fool's Day.
And he said, see you on down the road.
Yeah, and
that
then...
That's how he was at the NCAA Finals, and he said, see you on down the road, and then immediately went over to ABC and actually said out loud, I'm really happy to be at ABC. I get to do events I've always wanted to do, like the Little League World Series. You
were,
really?
Wow.
Really, Brent?
Well,
really?
A lot of people thought that when he went to ABC, he was going to try and Bigfoot Al for Monday Night Football.
He did not.
Never happened.
He did not. Yeah. No. I mean, he has a great voice. Why do I like him so much? Because he started in newspapers. I mean, he went to Northwestern. He went to the Medill School. I don't think he ever graduated. I think he left, you know, some credit shy, not a lot credit shy, because he got a job. And Andy, you know how that works. You did the same thing.
Yeah, I had a job once, and yeah, it was good to have that kind of thing.
But you left college.
I did.
To take
a
job.
You know,
that's why you're there. That's why Brent was there.
To get a job.
And he ended up as a columnist, I believe, at the Chicago American. Wilbon said yesterday on PTI, he said, when I realized I couldn't be Ernie Banks, I wanted to be Brent Musburger. I wanted to write.
Yeah.
This is before Brent was on television as a play-by-play guy.
He, I believe, got the first interview with John Carlos and Tommy Smith after the 68 Olympics incident.
Correct. Is that right?
And then in that iconic photo of Joe Namath by the pool, you see a guy in like white sneakers and
that's Brent.
And a tape recorder, and he was doing radio then. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was like, I really liked him. I like him personally. He was a guest many times on shows that I've done. He always called you laddie.
Yeah.
He always knew the points. He always knew the points. And there are people out there who have pecked at him over the years. They've pecked at him. And they're basically, most of those people are ants at a picnic table. I mean, most of them. Brent is gigantic. And I don't want to sit here and say, and always eager to help, but he would. I mean, you asked him a question. I was once offered a job in 1978 or 1979. I was working at the New York Times, and I had not yet gone down to the Washington Post. And I was called up by a guy who ran CBS Sports at the time, whose name is Van Gordon Souter. The two smartest people I ever met in television were Don Ohlmeyer, who told me the answer to all of your questions is money, and Van Gordon Souter. And he was running CBS, and he was an old, you know, newspaper guy, because everybody at that time was an old newspaper guy.
That's right.
That's where television hired. They hired newspaper people because they believed that newspaper people understood what the story was and how to get the story. And so I go up to the CBS offices. I'm working at the New York Times at that point, and I'm young still. I had hair. And I was sort of hot because, you know, the New York Times is what all the executives read in New York. I mean, they won't admit they read the news in the Post. They do, but they will put the Times out on their desk so that they look smarter. And he calls me in, and he says, like your stuff, I wondered if you'd be interested in writing for Brent Musburger. And I looked at him quizzically because I knew that Brent had been a newspaper columnist. I said, what do you mean writing for him? And he goes, well, you know, writing for him for what he says on TV. I said, well, writing what? Writing everything? He said, yeah, writing everything. I said, writing You Are Looking Live? He said, no, he can do that. I thought about it for 10 seconds and said, no. I mean, it's just not not what I wanted to do. It's not how I saw my own career path. But I also said to him in the walk-up to this, I said, I don't understand. This is why you'll appreciate why I think he and Ohlmeyer are that smart. I said, I don't understand much about television. Now, this is in the days. This is in the mid to late 70s, so not everybody has a clicker. It doesn't work that way. You have to manually change channels. You have to manually change volume.
How did you live?
Well, it happened.
You had to get up?
Yeah.
Had to get up.
Or smack your sister in the head. Maybe she'd do it.
No, you know what? If you threw a 20 out there, you'd get somebody else in the room.
Well, that's what I always try to do.
So I said, I don't know anything about television. And he said, what do you have to know? And I said, well, I don't know anything
What's
about television.
To know?
And he said, here's all you have to know. You turn it to the right to make it louder. Okay. I mean, you don't remember a lot of things that are said to you 45 years ago, but I remember that. And I didn't take the job. I'm glad I didn't take the job. But Brent, the stardom at that point, there's three channels at that point. The stardom level is amazing. Everybody knew Brent Musburger. Everybody recognized his voice. And he could have been a bad guy. I would tell you that I've been in circumstances, go back to Jimmy the Greek, and he liked to wear his diamond ring on everybody's nose, and Brent was not that way. Brent was not that way.
No, he's a Budweiser guy.
Yeah, very approachable guy. Yeah. And he conducted, and I've said this numerous times, the single greatest interview I have ever seen, he conducted with Bill Walton. And these were at the finals. Bill Walton.
God, Walton's the best.
In Walton's one great year, one healthy great year.
77.
With the Portland Trailblazers, they are playing the Philadelphia 76ers for the title. Philadelphia has gone up 2-0. Portland then wins 4 in a row and sweeps the rest of the series. And in one of the games in Philadelphia, I was working for the New York Times, and I didn't like to fly then, and I don't like to fly now, but it's easy to take the train or take a car to Philadelphia. So I did a lot of work in Philadelphia. They're playing in the Spectrum, which I think may still exist, but it's certainly...
No, I don't think so.
They tore it down?
It's gone.
I think they finally tore it down.
They tore it down completely? Okay. So we're in the Spectrum, and Bill Walton has this reputation of being non-communicative and not cooperative, which he came by honestly because John Wooden shielded all his players, much like John Thompson later, using the John Wooden example, shielded all of his players. And Bill Walton, you just sort of sat there, and he's being referred to derisively as Mountain Man, and and he was antagonistic to
He may have been high.
He may have been high. Totally antagonistic to the press, which, of course, he is not. He's total delight.
Oh, he's the best now.
But I bear a grudge. You know, I don't forget what it was like to try and cover this guy. And Musburger comes in, and he's got camera guy, he's got a lighting guy, he's got a sound guy, and he sits down next to Walton, and he takes his hand and he pats Walton on the thigh, and he puts the microphone out, and he says these 10 words: big guy, big guy, big guy, big guy, big guy. And he puts the mic under Walton. Walton doesn't say anything.
That's gold.
That's it. It's the single best interview I've ever seen. I admire Brent so much.
That was
that.
It?
That was it.
Probably it, yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
Walton didn't.
Existential.
Yeah, Walton didn't.
So
didn't
much talk. In that silence.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, sort of kabuki theater for Bill Walton. but I think it's fair to say, and I think that Jim Nance inherited, when they fired Brent, and I don't even know why they fired Brent.
Because he wanted to do baseball.
That, and they didn't want him to do baseball?
Remember, CBS had it for a couple of years.
Sean McDonough did the series, yeah.
And they it wasn't over money. It was that he wanted to do everything, and they said, we're not going to let you
do
every sport.
Well, all these guys did everything.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, Al did everything.
Yeah, Kirk Gowdy did everything.
Nance does everything.
Yeah, well, Nance got that job.
No, he doesn't do basketball.
He does the Final Four.
He does Final Four.
Yeah, not pro, though.
Yeah, no,
but
I mean,
but everything that CBS has,
he does everything.
I guess he does,
So they fire Brent, and Nance gets that job. And Nance at the time, if I'm not mistaken, is really young, maybe 30.
Now you say, yeah.
Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
He's doing the Utah Jazz. And all of a sudden, he's on CBS doing everything. Doing everything.
Well, but he wasn't. When he started at the Masters, he wasn't the 18th hole tower guy. I think he came up, you know, he had 15 or something like that, right? I mean, it wasn't just
he
like.
He was a sideline guy.
He's a legit
years.
Golf. He played on the golf team
with
in Houston,
Fred Couples.
With Fred Couples. Yeah. So he can.
No. He can get
spin,
it around.
Like he and Michael can talk about the ryegrass.
Exactly.
You know, so he knows what he's doing with that.
Fade.
And he did the tennis.
Yes.
Like Pat Summerall did the tennis for years on CBS.
And the golf.
Yeah, Pat did everything. Those four guys, Al Michaels, Pat Summerall, Keith Jackson, who had 1 year at Monday Night Football, but is known as college football, which is so important.
And baseball.
Brent. And Brent.
You wouldn't put Vern Lundquist in there?
Love Vern Lundquist.
No, I was just wondering.
I that's the A-list to me.
Vern broke in all the good analysts, including Madden. Vern broke him in.
Right.
He's great. Yeah. Everybody loved
working
with
him. But
he's
the next tier below that, right?
Yes, and it's a very high tier.
But he has the 16th hole at the Masters. He was not the A front of the store guy. The best and had some of the greatest calls, but he was not the guy.
And I know that golf is a niche sport, but the Masters
is not a niche thing.
No. I mean, NBC would die to have the Masters.
And they'll never get it.
No. They're, it's not going to happen. They can have everything else in the world, and it's not the Masters, which is obviously the unofficial start of spring and the tournament that everybody watches. It's the same reason. Fox never gave up. ESPN got everything you wanted in NASCAR, but they didn't get the Daytona 500. And if you don't have that, the rest of it doesn't really matter.
Correct.
And Brent
actually
will,
saw an
you know,
ad for the Daytona 500 already last night.
Yeah, that's right.
By the way, and what Brent is going to do is perfect. He's going to open up a tout service in Las Vegas.
I mean,
that's what he's going to do. That's what he loves. He loves gambling.
That was preordained. I mean, that was like, that was in the job description.
Oh, he's actually purchased a restaurant somewhere in the Friendship Heights area.
No, those are terrible investments. Everyone knows that.
You know what's going to happen?
It's called Brent's.
Yeah, Brent's.
He's calling it Shinebox.
The terrible nightmare is that it's going to, we'll unveil a sign, it'll say still Chad's.
Still Chad's.
But it'll say still
Chad's.
All right, let's get out of here. We're going to have email and a jingle when we return. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show. The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Can I switch topics? Dawson's Creek.
It was 1998, so Lizza just turned 22, watching a show for teenage girls.
Well, I mean...
Reading Sassy Magazine, listening to NSYNC, posters of unicorns on his bedroom wall.
How did you know that?
And the estrogen flows like falling water.
It's a show about life.
I don't want to wait for this segment to be over. Sorry, Satch, but I'm fast forwarding. I don't want to hate. We all have guilty pleasures, but this show has a guy on it called Pacey.
And the incomparable Robert Byrd from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania writes, Pacey, Satch, a guy named Pacey. Can I switch topic for a second? What do you think about calling your restaurant The Lead? And I would love to call it The Lead, L-E-D-E, but people would not know.
I'd
look at it and, you know, and they wouldn't really know.
I like TKs because that would be like TK, like, you know, in newspaper lingo.
Yeah,
got to fill it in. And your initials.
Head to come.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Before we get into the mailbag, I want to say thanks to Washington Post movie critic Ann Hornaday for coming on with us. I also want to thank our sponsors today, Blue Apron, ZipRecruiter, and SeatGeek. Please support them the way they support our podcast. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of The Tony Kornheiser Show wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And please, if you listen to the show through iTunes, leave us a review. That would be nice.
Breaking news, the ladies' shirt is actually live now. It just came in.
Very good. And how could people get that?
Again, shop.tonykornheisershow.com.
From Charlie Barron in Chicago, Illinois. I meant to mention this last week, but was reminded of it when it was mentioned on the show that Michelle Williams was nominated for an Oscar. She also played Jen Lindley, the troubled teen banished to the creek to live with her grandmother on Dawson's Creek. All of Chris's Creek fanboy cred has been revoked.
It's so true. Jen Lindley was a great character. That's where I first fell in love with Michelle Williams.
Did you actually subscribe to Sassy Magazine?
No. I mean, that is not true. And the
17.
Unicorn poster thing, there's, just for the record, the unicorn poster, there's no photographic evidence of that. So I'm no commenting.
From Daniel O'Regan, who writes, I'm a loyal little living about 2 kilometers as the crow flies from Melbourne Park, the scene of the Australian Open. I was literally running past Rod Laver Arena today when Tony was talking about the fact that this year's Open is being played in comfortable, unseasonable, cool conditions, and I just thought I would let you know that the day after the tournament ends is forecast to be 41 degrees Celsius or 108 Fahrenheit. Oh. Thanks for jinxing us, Grandpa.
Whoops.
3 friends and I listen religiously. Joel is no good to you as he is 6'3", but Alex and Chris are both 5'3", and given the fact that they are vertically challenged, I think they would be the perfect buyers for your solstice. The cost of a new battery and shipping to Melbourne shouldn't be too expensive, should it? No, only about $8,000.
Very reasonable.
From Werner Milano, things that go through Mr. Tony's head when they take a photo of his heart. 1, I shouldn't have eaten those bowling alley fries. 2, my heart is fine and I can bench press 315 and 310, 20, 30, 40. Your heart looks like a space capsule. It looks like the thing that, yeah, the
heptapod. Heptapod.
No. It looks like the thing that landed in the water. You know, the.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's sort of triangulated and
it looks like Virginia. Looks like Virginia, right?
No, that's oval shaped. Virginia's oval shaped. From Zach Berg, Lin-Manuel Miranda actually has an honorary degree from Yeshiva University. So the Jewish Hall of Fame can't be far behind. This would eventually give him the exclusive G-got, slightly edging your prestigious J. All right. From Brian Rowe. Each year I enjoy attending the Farmers Open Pro-Am as the Wednesday crowds are much, much smaller and the parking is free. Yesterday was a beautiful, clear, crisp, 65-degree day in La Jolla. Please tell Michael. And yes, I walked with Tiger. I walked with Phil. Big deal. Who cares? I was there to do one thing and one thing only. Find Steve Sands and yell at the top of my lungs, La Cheeserie. As I strolled along South Number 1, emerging from the media tent and hopping into a cart, there he was. Steve Sands, and this was my moment. My heart pounding in anticipation, I let loose a gleeful and hearty La Cheeserie. To my amazement, he stopped his cart and turned to address me. wow, I thought this is great. He then said, I'm Todd Lewis, not Steve Sayles.
But the fact that he knows that that's what people scream at Sayles.
He must get it a lot.
P.S. Do you guys have the Shaputzva to name your restaurant Shaputzvas? No, we don't. Good. From Neil in Rockville, might I suggest that you announce that Chaz will be hiring 10,000 new waiters over the next year to get a shout out from the Twitter-in-chief? It's hired 15,000 border guards?
Yeah.
15,000.
Amazon's adding 100,000 workers because of Donald Trump. That last part may or may not be true.
Oh, okay. Alex Bellius in Springfield, Pennsylvania, after listening to Cheeseburgers in Friendship Heights, it immediately joined my top three jingles of all time, right next to Trots, 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 and the one about the Marlin stabbing the fisherman. I'm blanking on the name. That has to be a Robert Berg.
That was
one,
a Robert Berg one, yes.
Sadly, this means balding Jordan Spieth had to get bumped from the podium. That, too, was a Robert Berg.
But I have a piano.
Yeah. From Gary Riggs in Granger, Indiana, in regards to an emailer who recently voiced concern that your podcast was going to be turned into a commercial for your new restaurant, I think that you should have the maitre d' call into the show halfway through, similar to when Matt Kelleher would call in with a PTR preview giving the specials of the day. I'm sure your listeners would be riveted to know the menu options of a restaurant 1,000 miles away. Second, in regards to names for said restaurant, I've noticed a trend here in the Midwest of restaurant names that are an adjective followed by a noun. Real examples are the Evil Czech, the Crooked U, or the more popular Tilted Kilt. My name suggestion for you, the Drunken Socialite.
Not bad.
That's not bad. If you're out on your bike time, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Come on, man. What are you doing out here, man?